Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest today is the former Prime Minister of Italy, Enrico Letta. Enrico's joining us from his home in Rome where he's in lockdown with his family. I first met Enrico nearly a decade ago when he visited Australia as a guest of the Australian government, and he called on me at the Institute's headquarters at 31 Bligh Street in Sydney. I liked him very much and we kept in contact, and I was delighted a couple of years later in early 2013 to see media speculation about Enrico Letta becoming Prime Minister of Italy. I stayed in contact with him during that period, and in 2013 I called on him at the Palazzo Chigi, which is the residence of the Italian Prime Minister, on Piazza Colonna in the historical centre of Rome. Enrico served as Prime Minister from 2013 to 2014. He helped to reset his country's international standing, and he was known for being an internationally oriented leader with a gift for building bridges. Now Enrico Letta is the Dean of the Paris School of International Affairs at Sciences Po, one of the top international relations schools in the world. Enrico Letta is one of the most thoughtful and knowledgeable observers of European and international politics, and I'm delighted he's agreed to join me on the Director's Chair. Welcome, Enrico.
Thank you very much for this presentation. I'm delighted to be here.
Enrico, let me begin by going back to the time when you became Prime Minister. You were in your mid-40s at that point. You'd had a very interesting career as a think tanker, a political advisor, and a European MP. And then suddenly you were the Prime Minister. What did it feel like to suddenly join the ranks of world leaders as the head of government of a major European power?
You know, you have to consider that the Italian political system is very different from the Australian one. It is necessary to find compromises among parties, so it is necessary to find leaders and to find frameworks that are not tested electorally. So it was my case, because the elections in 2013 were a no-result elections. The system was blocked after 2 months of negotiations. It seemed that the only solution was a grand coalition government. Parties agreed on my candidatures, and I was there, and it was a great experience, something new, but of course a very big fatigue to be there, and personal fatigue for private life, because you miss completely your private life for a period. I was with very young children at that time. They are still young, but they were younger at that time. So It is not easy. It is a fantastic experience. It is not easy.
What was the most interesting thing for you about being Prime Minister? What did you enjoy the most?
But of course, the possibility to be involved and to be in the decision-making process at European level in a period in which Europe was confronted with the end of the financial crisis and the new crisis we had, the refugee crisis, and Italy was in front row. So I was confronted to enormous challenges. And for me, of course, it was an important mission to be there and to try to reinforce the European spirit and to reinforce the Italian protagonism within the European Union. And of course, it's also the way to be in contact with your people. I remember tragic events, the dignity of people in tragic events, and also spectacular events. Italian culture is that make you proud to be the Prime Minister of your country. It was a fantastic polyedric experience.
Tell me about your relationships with other world leaders at the time, Enrico. How important are those personal relationships at the summit in terms of solving problems? And of your class of international leaders, who impressed you the most?
For a country like Italy, which is in the European Union, so Prime Minister is part of the European Council, in the G7 and in the G20, personal relationships are, I think, very important, because a large part of your international activity is within our other leaders in meetings like the European Council, the G7, the G20. So I think establishing personal, accountable relationships is one of the most important part, and you need this accountability and you need this continuity. In my time, I have, of course, very good souvenir. I remember it was defeated of Barack Obama. And it's very easy to say that personally, the relationship with him and also his vision, his style, his accountability was really astonishing. Also, if we compare with the present American leadership. But I have to say also, I had a very good relationship with the Prime Minister and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Australia at that time, Kevin Rudd and Bob Carr. I knew them and I had fantastic relationship with them in the different activities we had with that. And of course, also in with other important European leaders and leaders in the world. But if I may say, I was and I'm impressed by the difference I saw with the American leadership at that time and leadership of Barack Obama and the difference with today. I think it is what impressed me the most.
What about other leaders from the COVID class of international leaders? You've indicated you're not that impressed, perhaps, by the way President Trump is conducting himself. What about other European leaders and world leaders in the middle of this crisis?
But frankly speaking, I think European leaders, I mean EU27, I think at the end of the day, they managed in a decent way, even in a good way, this catastrophic emergency. If I see, for instance, the leaders of the European institutions, the leader of the European Commission, the leader of the ECB, frankly speaking, Christine Lagarde, Ursula von der Leyen, they were very good. You know, it's easy to make a comparison between this crisis and the financial crisis on 8-12. There's no comparison with how fast was the response of the European institutions now and 10 years ago. 10 years ago, they took 4 years from 8 to 12 to respond and to respond in an effective way. Whatever it takes of Mario Draghi came 4 years after the beginning of the crisis. This time, after 4 weeks, they were there and the response was good. I think leaders like Trump, like Bolsonaro, even Boris Johnson, I think the first denial of the crisis was a big, big mistake. And this is why I think this crisis is also a divide in the way in which leaders are managing the relationship with the people and the relationship, the public opinion and with the public service of country. And I think Europe had a good performance in that crisis in terms of leadership.
Let me come to Italy, which is one of my favorite countries in the world. And first of all, let me extend my sympathies for the trials that your country has been through in the last few months. And we read and we see the vision out of Lombardy and other parts of Italy with great sadness. We read the figures of at least, you know, more than 200,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus and nearly 30,000 dead. As a former prime minister, how would you assess Italy's response to COVID?
I was surprised, like all the Italians, by the pride of the reaction, the way in which country, the people of the country, we all decided to obey, to respect rules, even rules unexpected and really very, very hard to be obeyed. So it was, I think, a great example of pride, of self-consciousness, awareness by the Italian people. Of course, it was different from the political leaders. We had a lot of disputes, and that was not positive. No good relationship between majority and opposition, and that was a pity. I think that was a shame. At the same time, you have to consider that we had two Italy in this crisis, because we had Lombardy, and Lombardy was the global epicenter of the crisis. I think worst figures in the world were from a Lombardy region. The rest of the country had very few cases. So the average is a negative one, but it is the outcome of two different Italy. So I think the big problem was, and it was a big problem for the political national leadership, to find global national rules for two completely different situations. The one, I repeat, Lombardy, the worst case in the world, and the rest of the country where the situation was really manageable. So to block the rest of the country because of Lombardy was very complicated to impose to the people to be accepted, but people accepted.
Here in Australia, I think we watched with enormous admiration the footage in March of people singing from their balconies in Siena and Naples, and that old video of the Italian Air Force painting the sky with the colours of the Italian national flag. How has this experience changed Italy? Is there a new sense of solidarity in the country? Is there a new pride, a new sense of resilience, perhaps a new willingness to obey rules, which, as you alluded, is not something we ordinarily necessarily associate it with Italian culture? How will Italy be changed by COVID?
I think that can be a fantastic opportunity for the country to understand that we are good in being creative, in being flexible, but we can be good also in managing emergencies and in managing, in being accountable in difficult moments. I think, and I hope this awareness can last for the country, for country's mood. I'm sure that this dramatic experience can be good for the future of the country. Of course, I'm afraid that the economic recession that we have to face now will be another dramatic challenge, because lockdown for Italy means a cost of around 50 billion euros each month. That's enormous. It is 3-4 points of GDP each month that we lost because of lockdown. We are now at the third month. There's a reopening, slow reopening, but we will pay this bill, and the cost of this lockdown will be paid for the next months, and it will be a very, very expensive check. So I think the next period will be an important test for the Italian people, for the Italian leaders, for the Italian economic business people, to show resilience also in the reopening and in restoring confidence with financial markets, with the economic markets. And I'm sure also we will need to show solidarity, because social problems will be very high. Unemployment raise. Of course, it is not just Italy. All Europe will be confronted with this big recession that will be worse than the one we had in 8-12. But Italy will be confronted in a hardest way.
What will be the implications for the European project of COVID, do you think? What has it revealed about solidarity between European countries? What are the prospects of Italy being, I should say, of the European Union being an outward-looking entity that is seeking to have influence in the world? Or will Europe be drawn inwards to deal with both the viral epidemic and then the economic epidemic that you've mentioned?
You have to consider that this crisis arrives after four crises in a decade. Because in the last decade, we had the financial crisis, 8-12, that was terrible. Then we had the refugee crisis, another topic, but Italy was in the first row. Third, we have the terrorist crisis. Now we used to forget, but we had in 15 the Bataclan, we had in 15 an horrible period. And fourth, I mentioned Brexit. It is, and it was, an unexpected, unique crisis for Europe. So after four crises in the same decade, this crisis is there in a European Union that has a weaker European spirit, I have to say, where some nationalistic mood, some trends are growing, and some mistrust among countries is growing. So I think this crisis will be very complicated to be faced by the European leaders, institutions, and countries, because the big risk is to have, again, the typical divide between North and South and grasshoppers. That is typical of the narrative of our European Union. And the big problem was the fact that virus attacked mostly southern countries. And so you can have the big consequence can be the fact that the outcome of this crisis will be a new divide. Germany, as an outcome, can be more competitive after the crisis, because Germany has an enormous surplus and Germany can put a lot of money to restart of his economy. That is not the case for Italy or for Spain with our debts, and Italy more than Spain. So I am afraid if we don't have a European comprehensive response, if we leave only to the countries the response, the divide will be larger. And the Euroscepticism and mutual lack of trust among countries will raise, and that is a very bad news for the future of the European Union.
What about Italian and European views of the People's Republic of China? As you know, the relations with China is a preoccupation for Australians. We're at daggers drawn somewhat at the moment with Beijing over Australia's call for an independent, impartial investigation into the origins of the virus. And you do get a sense that in some parts of Europe, views on China are hardening. But is that the case in Italy?
Italy had a traditional good relationship with China. Belt and Road was part of this good relationship in the past. There are some cultural trends and some political parties in Italy, like Five Stars, for instance, pushing for a better, even a better relationship with China. So it is very strange because in this crisis, we experienced two completely different reactions to the Chinese within Italy and within the Italian society. At the very beginning, when China was considered as the reason of the virus in January, February, there was a sort of very bad behaviors against Chinese people in Italy. It was a shame, I think. It was a shame. Now it is quite the opposite because of some attitudes that some people in the country considered unacceptable from northern European countries, from the Dutch government or from some German leaders. So they started to say Chinese are better than northern Europeans because they want to help us, they want to work with us. So it is a mixed feeling relationship. I think Italy's tie with the Transatlantic Alliance and with the European Union is not in danger. And personally, I consider that the relationship with China for Italy and for the rest of Europe is very important. And we have to build up a strong relationship. But of course, it is not alternative to being European. It is not an alternative scenario. It is a completely different kind of relationship. And I think, I consider that Chinese leadership had very wise decisions in the last 5 years. I mean, for instance, the supporting of Paris Conference agreements on climate change while the US were out, for instance, or other decisions like that. But now it is very important that China decides to be accountable on coronavirus and on all these aspects. So I think we have to ask them to be accountable, to be reliable. I think it is very important to be all united in this request.
Let me ask you about international institutions, if I can. I remember when you hosted me at Palazzo Chigi, I was asking you about international institutions. And I think you said to me at the time that you thought the G20 was perhaps the most useful leaders meeting from your point of view, because it had all the leaders from the most important countries that you would need to solve most of the problems that were confronting the world at the time. Now, since then, the G20 has lost a bit of altitude. We haven't seen it being particularly prominent, for example, during this crisis. And we've also seen during the pandemic, the nation state come rushing back. We're all looking to our national leaders. We're tuning into speeches by our national leaders where the national state, the nation state seems to have the authority and legitimacy that is required to deal with this pandemic. And yet we also know that none of these global problems, including pandemics, are susceptible to national solutions. And we know that a vaccine won't be found without international scientific cooperation, and any international financial crisis can only be headed off with international coordination, and air travel can only start with international coordination, and so on. So where do you think COVID leave international institutions?
I think you're right. After COVID, there are many problems in the international affairs world. The first one is a sort of collapse of the transatlantic traditional community. Because if I think what was the kind of cooperation between Europe, UK, US, it was almost zero. Almost zero. And we were used to see U.S. leading in dramatic moments of history. And that time, it was exactly the opposite. But so the relationship between EU27 and the U.K. was a non-existing cooperation at that time. So my first point is that there's a very important priority for the post-COVID-19. We have to reshape a transatlantic community. And that will be the big mission for the next US president. And there's a big mission also for the UK and for the European Union, but we can't continue with this spread, this collapse of this transatlantic, very important tie. Second point, you mentioned G20. Yes, G20 is missing in action, like G7, if I may say. Mm-hmm. It's not by chance. They are both under two leaderships, the US on the one side and Saudi Arabia on the other side. And of course, it was not lucky to have two mm-hmm. kind of leaderships like that in this very period. But I think the future has to be a future of cooperation also at that level. So we have to relaunch G20 next year. Italy next year will chair the G20. I think it will be a great opportunity to relaunch the G20. And there's this co-chair UK-Italy of the Glasgow Conference on Climate Change. That is another opportunity. And if I may say, the only institution at world level, well, working in this period in terms of multilateralism is still Europe, because there's big crisis in the UN system and it's big crisis in all the different other international institutions. So I think we are entering a period after COVID where people having in mind that multilateralism is crucial and they have to fight for multilateralism. We have to stand for multilateralism because all the different challenges today are global challenges. Pollution, mm-hmm. virus, they are not national. They are global. Mm. They don't need passports to pass borders. So we need multilateral cooperation. I think the world of tomorrow will be a cultural fight around borders, around the role of borders. And I think we have to consider that cooperation is better than walls. And the only way to beat these kind of challenges or to overcome these kind of obstacles is to cooperate, is not to raise walls.
Let me finish, Enrico, by coming down from the global level to the local level. And let me ask you, what are you liking about lockdown? What are you learning about lockdown? We're all thinking about the negative aspects. We're missing the Italian restaurants and the concerts and all that sort of stuff. But we're also learning new things. We're spending more time with our family. We're having a more reflective time, perhaps. What are you liking about lockdown?
But of course, you mentioned family. And for me, it was an enormous gift because I spent my life commuting between Paris and Rome. That is a privilege because I'm talking about the two best cities in the world, maybe.
Careful.
No, yes, Pisa. Pisa is better. I come from Pisa, of course. But for me, it was a privilege, of course, to be here with my family, with children. It was great. But at the same time, I think we learned how big are the inequalities in today's world, in our societies, because this coronavirus crisis was not the way to be all at the same level. At the very beginning, we said, okay, the virus is a sort of equalizer. It is not, because it will be, for what I think, the push for more inequalities, within societies and for more inequalities for the relationship among countries. So that was for me a big lesson, also considering that, for instance, e-learning is a fantastic experience. But e-learning is also a way to create inequalities. For those who are in good shape, it is an opportunity. For those who are not, it can be an enormous fatigue. And to help them who are in difficulty, you need people who take care of them and who take care of them also in a physical presence. So I think this topic of inequality is, for me, one of the big lessons of this pandemic. Of course, it is one of the topics of the future.
Enrico, thank you for joining me today to reflect on your time as Prime Minister, but also to talk about Italy and the world in the era of COVID. Maybe we can agree that the four greatest cities in the world are Paris, Rome, Pisa, and Sydney. Thank you very much for joining us, Enrico Letta. We'd love to have you back to the Institute in Sydney at some time, and in the meantime, viva l'Italia.
Grazie, grazie, grazie.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.